A big part of our practice, as you all know, is really being present mindfully in the present moment. Somehow the now, here and now, is held up as being a central aspect of this practice, kind of where the practice occurs, and learning how to be in the present moment and learning to trust the present moment, learning to enter into it fully and embody it in a sense, is a big part of the task of this practice. But in emphasizing the present moment, it's easy to then too much push aside the past and the future as if it has no role in the present. In some ways, the past is here with us. In some ways, and maybe a little bit creative thinking, the future is here with us as well. And one of the ways that the past is here is all the cause and conditions that brought us here. And each of us has a different background, where we were born, our family, our life experience. Some of us were born in other countries, you know. And so there's so many different backgrounds that come here, and all those backgrounds kind of inform and are an important part of what happens here. It's part of the richness and the support for all of us. And, you know, who we are, given the kind of lineage, our ancestors, and how we ended up here with all that, is to be respected and held and honored as part of all this. So, whoever you are, whatever your background is, we hope that everyone feels that this is your place and there's a place for you here. And that you're respected for who you are. Part of the ancestral lineage that, in a sense, that you're all in is the teachers that Andrea and I have had, Bruni has had, and that there's a lineage of these teachers going back in time. And certainly they go back to the time of the Buddha. But it's interesting that I was fortunate enough to know my great-grandparents, some of them, and my biological great-grandparents. I also have a great-grandparent in the Dharma, and it's a Burmese monk by the name of Mingun Sayadaw. And this great-grandfather of mine, he was born in the 1800s, and in the late 1800s, was interested in meditation and learning meditation, and the practice of meditation had kind of fallen away in much of Theravadan Buddhism in Asia. It wasn't so common, and it started to be kind of rediscovered in the late 1800s as it kind of then became kind of a mass movement compared to what it had been. And there were a few monks here and there who did some meditation, but it was quite rare. And so this Mingun Sayadaw was interested in learning some meditation. And but he was looking for someone who could teach it to him. And he traveled all over Burma looking for someone who could teach him how to meditate, and wasn't satisfied with the people he met. And finally he heard about this monk, deep in the forest, who apparently knew about meditation. So he went there into the forest to find this man. And maybe this is where I get a little bit excessively romantic, but the idea of going into the deep forest for me is a wonderfully nurturing thing. And I think of, you know, it was before electricity really got established in Burma, certainly before telephones, let alone cell phones and computers and the internet. And so there was a kind of quiet and peacefulness that didn't have, nowadays there's a lot of loudspeakers in Burma, before loudspeakers and the stillness perhaps of the forest and great trees, and this forest monk who was sitting there practicing in the forest by himself. And I imagined it was a kind of very, just the environment, the place, I imagine, had a stillness, had an inspiration to it, to be there in this natural setting. I don't know if it was that the case for them at the time, but certainly given my background, for me to go into a place like that is such a contrast, and to feel the stillness, the naturalness, to have a vision of something that's bigger than myself, that holds us all. So Mingun side, I went to see this monk and asked him about meditation. And he got an interesting answer, response. The monk said something like, I don't have it quite right, but he said, you don't need to ask me. What you need to do is to read the Satipatthana Sutta, the teachings of the Buddhas, the Buddha's teachings on meditation. It's all the answers you want are there in that text. And so Mingun Sayadaw went back and started studying this text and started meditating based on this famous Satipatthana Sutta, the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And he practiced deeply and to great benefit. And he became the teacher for Mahasi Sayadaw. And Mahasi Sayadaw became the teacher for Upandita, who was my teacher, and in this Vipassana lineage. And in a sense, the modern era, we got our start with being pointed towards the Satipatthana Sutta. And then this whole movement that comes down to us here in the West has gone to Sri Lanka and to Thailand and spread around the world. This Vipassana movement, a big part of it had to start with that this forest monk pointing back to this text. So the theme for this retreat will be the instructions in this particular text, the text on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And it's a wonderful text, and it has a series of exercises or practices around mindfulness as a way of establishing mindfulness, is establishing awareness. And each of these practices is pretty wonderful in its own right. And as a set, they point to a variety of different ways to enter more deeply into our lived life, more deeply into our life as it's lived. And what I mean by that is it's many times we live in an abstract world of our general concepts, ideas of our lives. And so we see that through the filter of these abstractions. And one of the big ones is the abstraction of self, ideas of self-identity, me, myself, and mine. And the Satipatthana practices are practices that gets behind the filter, the veneer, the cloud of concepts and ideas to start connecting to our world in a more direct and, in a sense, real way, to connect to something which is not as a virtual reality like as some of our thoughts and ideas and concepts, but to actually the direct experience that we can have. And we start going underneath concepts, we see that there are different component parts that come together to kind of create our lived experience. And a hugely important one is the body. And so the first of these four foundations is paying careful attention to our physical embodied experience. The second is a little unusual for many people who haven't come to Buddhism to understand the value of it, but is the feeling tones of the experience, the ways that our experience is either pleasant or unpleasant, or painful, and the words are dukkha and sukha, so painful and happy or well. And these are powerful categories in which to understand our lives. And it turns out that a variety of different philosophers, thinkers, spiritual leaders, down through history, who have relied on direct experience rather than on gods and cosmic kind of transcendent reality kind of things, tend to find that this is one of the most reliable reference points for finding our path and our way, is a direct experience of what's pleasant and unpleasant. And so that's the second foundation. The third foundation is I like to think of it as the general quality of our mind, our mood, our mind states. Our mind states can take a variety of different forms and shapes or different qualities of it. And to become clearly aware of our mind state is a fantastic way of developing heightened awareness, heightened mindfulness that we can really start seeing more deeply. And then the fourth foundation is the dharmas, mindfulness of the dhammas. And among other things, this can be understood as the mental process. Once you understand the mental states, then we can have a better understanding of the mental processes involved that either keeps us enslaved, keeps us caught in bondage, or keeps us caught in cycles of suffering, or the mental processes that lead us to liberation, to freedom from suffering. These four foundations, there's different kind of practices within some of them. There's 13 total kind of practices described. And I like to think of them, it doesn't have to be seen this way, but I like to very much see them as a path. And a kind of a path of practice that one unfolds after the other, it kind of evolves. It begins with mindfulness of breathing. As you're connected to your breathing more, it's kind of often what follows from that is being more connected to your body. As we become more connected to our body, what tends to follow is more connected to the what's, you know, a little bit deeper, which is the feeling tones that we have. As we get more connected to the feeling tones, at some point it becomes a little kind of evolves to be more fully, richly cognizant of the inner life, the mental states that goes on. And as we become more attentive to the quality of the mental states, then what it can evolve is in seeing how those mental states and how the suffering comes into being, the forces that the processes tend to are operating there. And so it's kind of a path. And so we're going to go through in this retreat these exercises, these practices in Satipatthana. And there's many ways in which you might find it valuable for yourself. It might just be valuable for just how it helps connect you to the be connected to the present moment more fully, how it helps you connect more fully to yourself in a richer, more valuable way. It might also, for some of you, be valuable because you might find that as the retreat unfolds day after day, that maybe there's a little bit of a correlation between where you are in your own practice and where we're going, where we're traveling as we go through these different exercises. And so that would be nice if there was kind of some following along, or we follow you along with the teachings or something, because it ends with liberation. So that would be nice. One of the ways, where the beginning of all this is in the text is, where it all starts, is maybe with the first kind of instruction. And the instructions at the beginning that I like is instruction to say that one establishes awareness to the forefront. I like to translate sati as awareness more than as mindfulness, but both, you know, we can go back and forth. I go back and forth. So if you hear me say awareness, think mindfulness. If you hear me say mindfulness, think awareness, for me at least. So establish mindfulness. Establish this establishing of mindfulness, establishing of awareness is probably the most important part of all this. And kind of like all the other practices kind of support that establishment. And there's something about our capacity to be aware, to be present, in an open, clear, relaxed, maybe transparent way that is very satisfying in and of itself. And it's very helpful for helping to reveal the ways that we are caught, the ways that we get tied up in our experience, and shows us kind of a doorway to step beyond how we're tied up into a place where we're untied, where we're released and free, into greater awareness, greater freedom. And so this thing about establishing awareness and having some sense and appreciation of your capacity to be aware. Awareness only happens in the present moment. And so what is it about this quality of knowing? What is it about the quality of mindfulness or of attention that it can be so helpful? And to establish it is a beautiful thing. The idea, I find that kind of a wonderful thing, because it's the word establish is a different word than do it. You know, let's get on with it. And it's remarkable that in the suttas, as far as I can tell, there's nowhere where this word sati, mindfulness, is used in the kind of way that you should do mindfulness. Like this is something you should gear yourself up and do this thing, you know, apply yourself. And mindfulness is not presented as something we do, but more something we are, something we can establish, something's already here, and here we are. Not easy to be established, and so these different exercises, they are described different ways. We come to a stronger and stronger establishment of this awareness, open awareness, presence. And bringing our powers of observation to look carefully at the breathing, to look at our body, to look at the feeling tones, to look at the mind states. We gear up our attention to look, to notice clearly, to know, as an aid to being aware. And it might be a little bit confusing to have these different words that look similar in English, seem similar, but are pointing to two different things. That part which is active, we can actively pay attention, give our attention to something. I can tell everyone, to hear, I said, go look out the window there. And you would all turn your head maybe and look out the window. You're directing your attention someplace. But if I say, just be aware, there's no direction to that. Just take a moment and be aware. It's kind of like, what do you become aware of? I'm not directing it. It's not like you have to suddenly move your attention one place or the other. But we can do both. And one supports the other. So hopefully we'll kind of explore that little bit as we go along in the retreat. But right now I wanted to, as we start the retreat, to just highlight this beautiful quality of this establishing awareness, establishing mindfulness. And that's kind of both the beginning and the end, and the middle of a lot of this Satipatthana practice, the place of awareness, the place of simple mindfulness that can become a different kind of home for us. And that's kind of like the primary home we hopefully all can find refuge in and support, the home of awareness, home of attention. That's one of the safest places we can be, if we have safest homes we can have. And the nice things about that is that it's portable. You can't take IRC with you, but you can take yourself with you if you have that awareness established. So I hope that these teachings we offer this week is going to be supportive of you and helpful. In the course of supporting you, we'll offer practice discussion. And you'll have a chance to alternate between meeting with Andrea and myself. And we'll start those process of practice discussion on Wednesday. So it's been the first 2 days kind of settling in. All of you have some experience of being in retreats before and know that there's a settling in period and people are often tired and, sometimes the first day is called the swamp. And the body hurts and people get headaches and, it's kind of like we don't want to advertise what happens the first day. no one would sign up. But we want to say it's often, settling takes a while, it's a transition. And some of it's a lot being very patient with it and gracious with it and generous to yourself and taking some extra naps. But to spend the first couple of days with settling in process, and then we'll start the regular cycles of practice discussion on Wednesday. And we'll talk more about that as we go along.
As we settle in to our practice, opening to our experience below the level of concept, as Gil was speaking about, really meeting ourselves, understanding how what's arising in this moment is coming to be, it often takes courage. This work that we're engaged in puts us right in touch with the ways that we struggle, the ways that we get caught. And often, though, at the same time, it is also supporting us to cultivate qualities of mind and heart that allow us to have this courage. The qualities of love, of generosity, of compassion, of joy, of concentration, of mindfulness, the establishing of mindfulness. And so the work we do both simultaneously cultivates these beautiful qualities and puts us right in touch with what's hard, what's challenging. And so it's helpful to reflect on ways that we can find refuge or safety as we engage in this practice. The word refuge, this is the word we often use for what we'll be exploring in the next 20 minutes or so of taking refuge, going for refuge, finding a place of safety in which this work is possible. Our usual way of finding safety in the world, our usual ways of trying to stabilize ourselves and feel okay about ourselves often have to do with acquiring things, or if we just reflect for a moment on where do we typically think of safety as coming, having a livelihood that supports us, or having a relationship or friends that we can connect with, all of those things that we typically think of as our refuge in our lives, they're all impermanent, ultimately unreliable as a place for lasting refuge, a place for lasting stability of mind. And the Buddha acknowledged this and recognized this in his practice and in his teaching to the community, and encouraged us to explore shifting our perspective on where a more reliable refuge might be found. Shifting our perspective to, as Gil was pointing to, the we can't take IRC with us, but we can take this establishment of mindfulness with us. And the establishment of mindfulness creates a kind of a container that has much more of a sense of ability to meet just what is happening in our lives. And in a way, we could say that that is a truer kind of reliability, of refuge, of safety. If our hearts are able to not shrink or freak out or become reactive with what's happening in the present moment, there's a possibility for acting perhaps not out of reactivity, but out of wisdom and kindness and compassion instead. And so traditionally there are three refuges that we can explore, and I do think of it as an exploration. We as a community, at the beginning of retreat, as a kind of a ritual and a way to enter into the retreat, we go for refuge, and you've all done this before. And yet it's not for me something just to do at the beginning of the retreat. It really can be an alive process, and a reflection and a practice to explore where am I trying to find safety right now, and is there a way in which to land in refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, refuge in the Sangha, as a support for the cultivation of this mind that allows us to meet just exactly what's here in this moment without reactivity. And refuge in the Buddha, in a way, I think of these three refuges as really they're interrelated aspects of a single refuge. In a very overarching way, I think of refuge in the Buddha as being taking refuge in our capacity to wake up, taking refuge in the capacity that we have as human beings to establish this kind of mindfulness that allows us to be non-reactive with just what's happening in the present moment, to be able to navigate our lives not through reactivity, but through wisdom, through compassion, through equanimity. And so the refuge in the Buddha, if we think about the Buddha was a human being who basically found the possibility for freedom. And what he said to us is, I found this in myself, and it's possible for you to find this too. As human beings, this is something that's possible for us as human beings. And that, to me, is what refuge in the Buddha means. That we recognize and acknowledge that as human beings, we have a capacity to relate to the world in a completely different way, a non-intuitive way often. But through this exploration of what's here in this moment, what are the conditions that have created this moment? And so I think of refuge in the Buddha as that, recognizing, right, I'm a human being and this is possible. The Buddha was a human being. And there's some measure of trust there, some measure of faith or confidence that when the Buddha says, it is possible to wake up. If it were not possible, I wouldn't ask you to do this. This is taking refuge in that capacity that we have as human beings. And at times on retreats, I come back to that. It feels like, wow, I just barely can do the practice. But wow, there I take a step and I know the experience. It's just the possibility of awake is here in a moment. That's a human capacity. It's just a natural piece of our being human that we have this possibility. So that's one aspect of the refuge, that we have this capacity. The second is refuge in the Dharma, which I, in the broadest sense of the word, think of that's what we wake up to. Refuge in the Buddha is really about our capacity to wake up. Refuge in the Dharma is what we wake up to, this present moment lived experience, this human experience in this moment. And the Dharma has multiple meanings though, and so, in some sense, the capacity that we have as human beings to wake up and be present in this moment, the arrival to recognize the truth of what's happening in the present moment, and in a way, or the nature of what's happening in the present moment. Dharma, the word Dharma, also can be translated as nature or truth, that we are waking up to the truth of the nature of experience. This is that we can do that, and that the the possibility of doing that, when we wake up to that truth, even for moments, there is refuge in the Dharma. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, this is actually the true refuge. Bhikkhu Bodhi, a great translator of the Pali texts, he says that the refuge in the Dharma, the refuge in that awaking, that establishment of mindfulness that lets us wake up to the truth of this moment, the nature of this moment, that as we wake up to that nature, the mind understands that it doesn't need to defend itself or protect itself from this moment, but can be in this moment. That is the true refuge, ultimately. That possibility. Freedom. And the Dharma, another definition or meaning of the word Dharma is the teachings and practices of the Buddha, our practice. And sometimes that's what we can take refuge in. And we reflect on some of the teachings we've heard, and it inspires us in this moment to keep going. Or we recognize that what I need to do right now is just take another step. Just do the practice. Just breathe in, knowing that I'm breathing in. One of the instructions from the Satipatthana Sutta. Breathing in, knowing that I'm breathing in. That maybe that is, it's not possible in that moment to fully open to this breath, that there may be some resistance, and yet we land in the refuge of, but I'm connecting to the practice. I'm on the path. I'm doing the work that opens the heart and mind. This is also a way that we can, in practice, take refuge in the Dharma. And then the refuge in the Sangha, I think in the overarching way, is a refuge in the community that supports us, both the community that we have here as a form of support, but also when Gil talked about his grandfather in the Dharma, this also evokes, the refuge in the Sangha also evokes a kind of a lineage for all of us that goes back to the time of the Buddha. And as Gil has sometimes said, the Dharma is passed from warm hand to warm hand. That teacher that Mingun Sayadaw went to, that was a contact there. It was a personal contact, and he said, read the Satipatthana Sutta. Essentially, I can imagine some kind of transmission. I read the Satipatthana Sutta, and it helped me. You'll find it helps you, too. And so the support of Sangha to inspire and encourage us. Dharma is passed from warm hand to warm hand. This lineage of teachings, there's a line of people, of beings, that go from us all the way back to the Buddha, that have support, that have supported us to get here. And we have this community, this group of people to support us in our practice together. So many times on retreat, I have felt a little bit, maybe sometimes a lot, of confusion or despair or inability to continue. And I'll open my eyes and I'll see somebody else sitting there. One time, a very clear memory at one point, I opened my eyes and I saw somebody moving very mindfully, moving their hands to shift their hands. And in that moment, I was brought right into mindfulness myself in the seeing of that. And so much appreciation for the practice of that person in that moment to help me land back in the present moment. And so we support each other here. So we can, if there are times when We feel that we're struggling. Sometimes a reminder of these refuges in some fashion. I'm a human. This is possible. The Buddha said this was possible. Can I take some faith from that, or some trust from what the Buddha said, that it's possible? Can I engage in the practice? Can I allow myself to be supported by the community? And so these are the refuges that we align with to help us remember that the work that we're doing requires us in a way to let go of our usual ways of security. And yet, the Buddha acknowledging, yeah, we need some other things to land on. So these supports, these will be supports for you in your practice. Another support for our practice together in community, and it is very much a Sangha practice. It's a practice of ethical conduct, of non-harming. And this is another piece that we enter into in this container together, is that we agree to engage with the precepts, the five precepts: refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what is not offered, refraining from engagement with sexuality on the retreat, celibacy in lay life, refraining from creating harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech, and here engaging with noble speech, noble silence, where we primarily speak only when necessary, or in the practice discussions, or when necessary in our work meditations. And so there is a little bit of a addition. It's not just in retreat. It's not just about refraining from false speech. It's really about refraining from unnecessary speech and committing to the silence and refraining from intoxicants that cloud the mind. We're cultivating clarity of mind here, and so intoxicants get in the way of that. And yet, of course, if you have medication that you're taking that your doctor has prescribed for you, please continue taking the medication. This isn't about not taking medication that is prescribed for you. And so these precepts, they're not about, and I like to remind myself of this often, that they are also practice. It's not about kind of rigidly trying to force ourselves into some kind of should about these. But rather, what I like to think of these as kind of mindfulness bells. If we're getting ready to do one of these actions, if we're getting ready to kill a mosquito or a spider, or if we're getting ready to harm a living being in that way, if we're getting ready to take something that's not offered, if we're getting ready to lie or create harm through sexuality, then our mind is clouded. Our mind is probably motivated by greed, aversion, or delusion. And the Buddha encouraged us basically to say, hey, these if you're going to act, if you're going to take one of these actions, it's probably worth it to not do the action. And yet it's not about necessarily like saying squash the feelings that go along with that. And so the desire to pick up the shoe and kill the spider on the wall, it's not about repressing that. It is about not acting on that. And to begin to explore, ooh, what's there? What is that feeling? Seeing if we can establish mindfulness around what's arising there. And so these are mindfulness bells. If we're getting ready to do one of these actions, it's like our practice of the precept says, pay attention. There's something to look at here. Something's going on in your mind that's really worth looking at right now. There's probably some suffering there in your heart. Open to it. Explore it. But it's not about repressing that. It's a delicate dance of feeling the feelings and not letting the kind of urge to act leak out into our behavior. One of the great things too about the precepts is the understanding that as we engage with this practice of not following through on the urge to take life or take what's not given, is that there's the possibility in that refraining from to connect with and cultivate beautiful qualities of mind as we don't follow through on the urge. It's said that each of these precepts is paired with a corresponding beautiful quality. And so the action of refraining from taking life begins to open the heart to compassion. The action of refraining from taking what's not given begins to open the heart to contentment, of being content with what you have already. The action of refraining from creating harm through sexuality cultivates a kind of integrity. Refraining from false speech cultivates truthfulness, and refraining from intoxicants cultivates clarity of mind. So if you are interested in watching the whole process, there's also the possibility of seeing some of the cultivation of these wholesome qualities at work. And so at this point, we'll take the precepts, the refuges and precepts together as a community, as a way to enter into the retreat container, a kind of a formal entering into the silence together. And we'll do this through chanting the refuges. We'll just I think we'll chant the refuges together. I think probably there's enough, people know the refuges enough. If you don't know the refuges, you're welcome to just sit and let them wash over you. Basically, we'll take, first we'll have an homage to the Buddha. The first part is an homage to the Buddha, a recognition of this being who has taught us. And then we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then for a second time, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And for a third time, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then we'll do the precepts in English, and I will say the line in English, and then it'll be call and response.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiampi Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. Tatiampi Dhammang Saranang Gacchami. Tatiampi Sanghang Saranang Gacchami.
I undertake the training
to refrain from killing living beings.
I undertake the training
to refrain from taking that which is not given.
I undertake the training
to refrain from sexual activity.
I undertake the training
to refrain from false speech.
I undertake the training
to refrain from intoxicants,
which cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Thank you for entering into this container together. So we will end here at this point for the evening. And it's nice to have a little bit of an early evening tonight so that you have a chance to get some rest, some extra rest, especially with the extra early morning bell. So rest well, and we'll see you at 5:30 for the morning sitting.